This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه ومن والاه. Welcome everybody to the Safina Society Nothing But Facts live stream. Omar, let me see the image, please. Here, you turn this on. Click, keep clicking away, as only a Moroccan can do. We're here today on a very interesting subject that we're going to be covering today. Let's go. Keep it green. You're good to go. Of course, in the past week, in the past few days, the Syrian revolution has occurred, and in which I don't know if we could say there were heavy casualties, but of course it did garner a lot of attention. The Pakistan protests had actually probably, I think, more casualties. Nonetheless, I want to begin with a couple themes. Number one, the importance of a concern for the ummah. And you know that Nothing But Facts, we talk about kalam, basically theology, current theological issues, debates and discussions. But we're also, we cover the awliya. We study the people of Allah and their stories, which we haven't done in a long time, but we read from Ar-Risala Al-Qushayriya. But also, we're concerned with the affairs of the ummah, and we promote activism, we promote action. We're not the type of people of tasawuf that just sit around with a misbaha and food and mawalid. I'm just not for that, to be honest with you. I'm for that 10%. Okay? 15%. But we need action. We need ilm, amal, haraka baraka. That's what we need. And a lot of our counterparts throughout the world, they I have to say, to be honest with you, they don't do that. And I want to say that I don't really believe in that. Honestly, a lot of our counterparts, their action is not something that's really on the list. And maybe, I can't blame them, maybe they literally can't. Like, they literally cannot. Like, in some cases, there's no majal for them. But when I look around, I say, hold on, why are other people taking action? Why are other groups active? Haraka baraka, that's what we believe in, and that's what we need. So for the people who share our aqidah and madhab and maslak in the deen, and menhaj in the deen, not all of their modes of actions do we all agree on. I'm definitely for action in any way, shape, and form. And I'm for not fearing backlash, for having courage. What separates winners from losers, successful from unsuccessful? And I don't want to say men from boys, but that's an expression. But under pressure, how do you react? And are you willing to go against the grain? That's the question you have to ask. Let's talk a little bit of principles on the Syrian matter. we have to have concern for the Ummah. There's no doubt about that. Okay. And that's why I've been tweeting and retweeting news surrounding on this issue for a long time, for a while now. Okay. The last few days. I wasn't on the first day, and I saw a guy saying, Shadia Masri, silent. Yeah, but I wasn't even on the phone. I don't have my phone on me all the time to tweet, tweet, tweet. But as soon as I got on the phone and got on my computer, I mean, some days I'm not on the computer or phone at all. Neither. You have to unplug sometimes. And I don't care what the heck's happening in the world. I'm replugging. I'm not a journalist to have to do that. I'll plug in when I plug in on my own terms. And when I did, I'm constantly putting out news. Concern for the Ummah is the number one theme we have to have. Number two, we have to make judgments based on knowledge. Al-hukmu an shay' far'un an tasawwurihi. Most of the stuff that's going on is hearsay. I can't take it and run. And so it took me actually a while to navigate the situation, and I actually stepped on some mines and got caught up in some articles and news sources that turned out to be unreliable. You learn as you go on, but you got to admit your mistakes. So I delete those tweets. Simple as that. It's a mistake. You think something's good. You learn later on this person is biased and their presentation of facts is not reliable. Okay, you live and learn, right? This is not deen and shara where you have to actually be absolutely certain. It's an analysis. It's a political analysis. And sometimes that person turns out not to be what you thought. So you undo it. No problem. I have no problem saying, click, delete. Oh, you deleted it. Yeah, and? And what is this like, aqidah here? No, it's political analysis. Sometimes they're on point and sometimes not. Secondly, we know that what Bashar al-Assad, we know him. And not only is Bashar, he's an evil guy who's killed so many, and it's actually deen to be against this guy. It's hukum shar, because it's absolutely certain what he's done. We have no doubt on what he's done. And to be near this person is to be near the oppressor. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said, forget being against people, okay? All right? Forget being against people. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, subhanallah. What's the ayah that I always quote on this? I can't believe it's for skipping me right now. It is, وَلَا تَرْكَنُوا إِلَى الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا فَتَمَسَّكُمُ النَّارِ. Do not lean towards them. Do not support them. Do not even lean in their direction. وَلَا تَرْكَنُوا. الرُّكُون here means to seek their protection. It means to support them. And it even means to like have a leaning towards them. Of course, to support them and seek their protection is the number one tafsir for that. But even associating yourself, allying yourself in some way, shape, and any way, you're going to get hit with what they get hit with. So the position on Bashar, someone like Bashar al-Assad, I think it's a religious position, because it's not allegations against him. It's actual, absolute, certain fact that's been for years like that. And therefore, to denounce him, al-bara' minhu, and to hate him, al-bughd fillah. Allah's messenger commands us to love for Allah and hate for Allah. So some people, you have to hate them. And what does hate mean? Maybe it means you utter no word of support, no word of sympathy, and you utter words of disavowal and condemnation of this person. And that's what you should have in your heart. So that's known. So that's principle number one, concern for the Ummah. Principle number two, specifically on Bashar. Principle number three, the position on the rebels. And are they even rebels? Because the whole place is rubble. It seems to be the whole country is like a no man's land outside of Damascus. But anyway, let's just, if they're called rebels for the sake of it. Not all of rebellion is unlawful. In the Sharia, we know that, and we've had rebellions before in our Sharia. So we should all know that. Okay. But these groups, if we pass a judgment on them, it's got to be based on knowledge, and there should be no shame in somebody saying, I don't have knowledge on them. I hear a lot of hearsay. Just because someone trustworthy tells me, listen, trust me, I know shiuch, I know people on the ground, this is what's going on. That's not sufficient enough in such a huge issue like this, because I just can't take, maybe I can believe that, but I can't take that and run as if it's fact. It's still hearsay. There are way too many, he's saying Aleppo is not rubble. What I mean, I mean that like metaphorically, meaning that there isn't a government that's solid and stable that has been running the country in the way of other countries. That's what I mean by that. Nonetheless, in any event, in other words, there's hands in the pot. Unlike other countries, the Russians have hands in the pot. Mossad has hands in the pot. CIA has hands in the pot. ISIS, Al-Qaeda, these different groups, HTS, all these groups have hands in the pot. That's what I'm saying. It's not a clean cut, crisp nation the way others are, where it's more controlled. That's what I mean by that. And I think we all know that's true. How are we supposed to form a judgment? We can research, we can study, but ultimately at the end of the day, there is it going to be an absolute certain fact of what's going on the ground? I feel that there's so many hands in the pots, so many hands in the pot, so many claims, so many counterclaims. There are some people who treat it as if it's absolute fact that these rebel groups are righteous and pious, and if you don't support them, it's as if you're not supporting the people of Gaza. Others, they roll their eyes, they laugh at you, and they say we know of absolute fact that they're Mossad pawns, and the Mossad is playing puppets with them. Between these two, you can't blame somebody who's left in the middle and really not knowing what to think. But let me ask another question. If we can form an opinion, fine and good, but if you cannot, you're not harming or benefiting anyone by not having an opinion on a certain group, right? So, we're divided. Okay, well, what if we were unified? Are we having an impact? We're not. If we're unified, are we having an impact? That's the question. Opinions. We were all unified on Gaza, and yeah, maybe it had an impact on an election here and there, but Netanyahu is doing what Netanyahu is doing. And the whole world's opinion, the United Nations taking the guy to court, or wanted to, and no one, nothing changed. So let's not also overrate our opinion on the matter, okay? Let's not overrate that, because that may not necessarily. Now, what do we do have? We do have something in our hands, all right? Omar, do you have the GRT link? Yes. You want me to send it to you? Okay, let me send you the link, because we do have something in our hands. And something that is an objective fact is the idea that we are sending people through GRT and some of our own guys. Omar, are you going this year?
No, I can't.
Or is it Salman this year? GRT is one of the sponsors of this live stream. We work with them. And let's put up the link for that, and let's put the board on. This is something we do have objective knowledge of, and we have action. It's an actionable item. Tweeting has not changed the world, I don't think, last I checked, right? But this will change a life or two. We're trying to hit 50K. We're trying to go to 50K pounds, British pounds. We're at 6,000 right now. If we can get this to 6,500 today, I'll be happy, because I don't put pressure. It's just 1 pound here, 2 pounds there, 3 pounds, and it's not going to me. It's not coming in my hands even. It's going to an official, accepted, licensed in the UK charity called Global Relief Trust. That's our number right now, 6,330. Let's just get it to 6,500. That's it. And once we hit 50K, and maybe even before that, we're one or two Safina Saidi guys will be joining GRT to give you the qat'i evidence, although it's video, qat'i evidence, the video of our guys handing out blankets, hanging out this, handing out that. Omar, why don't you even put the footage of yourself from last year? Get that footage from WhatsApp of yourself from last year giving stuff out to show the community, show the world, this is not an empty thing that's a scam. This is legit, alhamdulillah, happy to say, completely and totally. If I didn't have the qat'i evidence of Omar himself, this guy who's behind the screen in Syria, face reveal, he might get married, in Syria, handing stuff out, and I, and we know this for a fact, I wouldn't be so comfortable, right? But we have that information, we have that qat'i evidence. You know, epistemology is so important. Epistemology is what's shrink it more. Oh, they're larger. Okay, because we want to see. We want to see Omar. All right, go. Click. Bismillah. There he is, folks. That's our guy. I see him with my own two eyes. Okay? Qat'i evidence that he's on the ground in... What city was that, Omar?
This was near
Aziz. Syria.
Near Halab.
Near Halab, folks. Move the mouse because I'm making it... Yeah, look at that. Tent city, like people living their lives like that, and we're here sitting and enjoying our pizza. This is right out of Halab, and we're here sitting enjoying our thin crust New Jersey pizza brought to us by our Moroccan friend Yassine from Toronto, and we're enjoying this hot pizza every single day whenever we want. Okay, Mr. Coolio, he has a suggestion for Omar for a wife. Okay. Omar's already, you know, he already has four wives, right? Yeah, you know what they are? Nahu, Mantiq, Aqidah, Fiqh. Those are, that's who Omar's married to these days. You know, Omar, if the Qiyamah came, he wouldn't know. He's literally under a rock. You know when the Talib Ilm gets under a rock? When a student of knowledge is literally under a rock? Omar is now under. And I'm accepting of it because it's temporary. And he's a Talib Ilm too. Today we have a special guest, one of the foremost political analysts in our community. And he has a lot of information we're going to discuss today. I'm going to give him the mic first to give what he wants to tell us. And then I have some questions on what's going on and what information we have. So let's bring our guest on today. Welcome Sami Hamdi to the Safina Society Nothing But Facts live stream.
Thank you for having me, Sheikh Shadi. Hope you're well. Hope everything's good in New Jersey.
Alhamdulillah, very good, very good. And where are you filming out of? Are you in London?
I'm in Dallas at the moment.
You might as well move to the United States at this point. Look, we had so much to talk about, from the abandoned Biden that turned to abandoned Harris that turned to Kareem Harris at the polls. But we have other stuff that we want to talk about today. Why don't you begin telling us and telling our viewers your thoughts, immediate thoughts on Syria, if you have any. I'm sure you do.
I think that, first and foremost, I think the offensive by the armed groups in Idlib, the opposition groups, I know people are referring to them as rebels against Bashar al-Assad. I think that it came as a surprise for everyone, including the Russians, including Assad himself. And there are some reports even suggesting it came as a surprise for Turkey too. And I think the speed at which that they've been able to take Aleppo, and now they're on the outskirts of Hama, and there's reports suggesting they might take Hama too. And there's even talks now that perhaps they might even, after Hama, go towards Damascus. There's a flurry of diplomatic activity in the region. Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi crown prince, who hadn't been to the UAE since 2021. There are some tensions between him and the UAE. He flew in the midst of the news to Abu Dhabi to meet with Mohammed bin Zayed. Amidst news that bin Zayed of the UAE had met with the Americans to tell them, you shouldn't let Assad fall. If Assad falls, it might cause a domino effect in the region. I think that this attack essentially has taken everybody by surprise. But I think that those who are watching Syria are not expressing surprise so much as with regards to the offensive, but perhaps with the gains itself. Because 2 years ago, Jolani, the head of the armed groups, the head of the Hay'at Tahrir al-Sham, the HTS, actually gave a speech or a khutbah in which he said, we're almost ready militarily to begin an advance that's taking forward. And it's important to put this offensive into context. Everybody looking at Syria or analyzing Syria was arguing that Assad, all he had left was to take Idlib. There was this suggestion that he had won, this suggestion that that's it, the Syrians just have to accept it, they just have to live with it, and that therefore they had no longer had any agency, and that it's about Turkey, Russia, Assad and the like. I think what's become abundantly clear in the past week is that Syrians do actually still have agency, and people do have agency. And I think that when you consider how what the situation looked 5 months ago, where Erdogan, the Turkish president, was saying to Assad, come to Turkey, let's sit down, let's talk, let's discuss, the idea being that the Turks were looking for an opportunity to make peace so they could ship out the refugees from Istanbul or from Turkey that have become a source of economic crises, according to nationalist Turks. I think when you look at Erdogan going from, I want to talk to Assad and sit down with Bashar al-Assad, and then the Russians bombing Idlib relentlessly in preparation for an offensive by Assad on Idlib, there's a complete turnaround of the situation, which suggests that the Syrians do have agency. I think these cities are being liberated. I know that's a controversial term for some people, but certainly they are being liberated from Assad strongholds. And to be honest, nobody is sure how far it will go. And I think that certainly it's upended the system in a way whereby now I think the regimes in the region are watching and praying that Assad doesn't fall. And that doesn't apply just to one particular spectrum. It applies across the whole spectrum, where even those who said they were against Assad are now concerned that if Assad falls, it might actually cause a domino effect that could transform the entire region. And Sham does have a special place in Islamic history. Whatever happens in Sham affects the rest of the Ummah, affects the potential of the rest of the Ummah, the opportunities in the rest of the Ummah. And liberation of Sham may lead to liberation of Palestine. But at this moment, it's unclear how far it will go.
Tell me the liberation itself, as we're going to use that term, is it occurring through one group or it is a conglomerate of different people and groups?
There are three main groups that are against Assad in Syria. The first of them, which is the group that's leading this particular offensive, is Hay'at Tahrir al-Sham, the HTS. Mm-hmm. HTS led by a man called Jolani. Once upon a time, he declared his allegiance to Al-Qaeda, then separated from them and went to war with them and then eradicated them from Idlib. The forces that he commands are an amalgamation of Syrians who fled from other territories and came to Idlib itself. They don't belong to a particular faction. Some reports suggest there are 27 different factions under Hay'at Tahrir al-Sham, under those groups that operate underneath it, of various different ideologies and the like. And I think that amalgamation is what has allowed those of the Christians and the Druze and some of these other religious sects to come out on social media and say that we haven't been harmed by HTS and we actually feel quite good now that they've come and taken this place itself. But in any case, that you have the HTS. You also have the SNA, what's called the Syrian National Army. This was a group set up by Turkey in 2017. Turkey wanted to establish a force, an auxiliary force that it could use in Syria that wasn't composed necessarily of Turks, because if Turks die in Syria, it causes domestic problem. But if other ethnicities die in Syria, then it's okay. It's more expendable. So this SNA is not ideologically aligned, but has more acted as a mercenary force by which it has gone after some so-called ISIS areas and essentially done whatever Turkey wants it to do in the region. And the third group that's against Assad, or rather that flip-flaps between Assad and the other rebel groups, is the Syrian Democratic Forces, SDF, which are the Kurdish separatists, those who are aligned with the PKK in Syria, those aligned with the YPG. It was a rebranding because the Americans felt that if Assad was going to stay in power, we don't want him to rule all of Syria. We don't want the rebels to conquer Syria. So let's sort of prepare for a division of Syria. We leave the rebels in the northwest, we leave Assad in the south, and we leave the Kurdish entity, an independent Kurdish entity, in the northeast. We don't want Islamist Kurdish entities. A lot of those are actually working with HTS. We prefer secular Marxist leftist Kurds, very similar to the PKK. They're in the northeast themselves. As it stands, the Hay'at Tahrir al-Sham are the ones who have allegedly launched this attack on their own. The report suggests that Turkey was uncomfortable with this attack. And Turkey actually, on a number of occasions, whenever HTS have gone out on their own, Turkey have initially supported them and then withdrawn that support. And that's why I think some people are concerned about this. Many will remember, I think it was 2017, 2016, when Hayat Tahrir al-Sham went to a place called Saraqib. The Turkish drones went with them to support them. But when Hayat Tahrir al-Sham looked like they would take it, then Turkey withdrew the drone suddenly, and Hezbollah was able to come in from Lebanon and wipe the floor with those forces that entered Saraqib. So it's unclear to what extent the Turks are supporting Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. What suggests that the Turks are interested in supporting Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, at least for the short term, at least until what we see now, is that the SNA, the Syrian National Army, which was built by Turkey in Syria, they have been deployed to Tel Rifat, they've been deployed to some of these areas over here, suggesting Erdogan, even if it turns out to be true that he didn't support the original offensive, he wants to take advantage of this momentum in order to boost his negotiating position on the table with the Russians and with Bashar al-Assad. Remember, for Erdogan wants to start closing a lot of the files to focus on his economy, which is why he reconciled with Saudi, reconciled with UAE, trying to reconcile with the Russians, trying to keep the peace with the Israelis, even as his people go ballistic over what's happening in Gaza, trying to give statements here, but keeping the trade going, trying to make more statements and suspending some trade, but keeping the oil going through the Ceyhan pipeline through Turkey itself. Erdogan is trying to hold the stick from the middle to say, I don't want any problems. I don't want any hassle. I want to reconcile with everybody because this economy could ruin my legacy. But I do think that Erdogan, in the deployment of the SNA, the Syrian National Army, between quotation marks, be wary of the names they suggest entities other than what they actually are. But in any case, the Syrian National Army that Turkey built has been deployed, it is marching, which suggests there's still some support there. Those are the three main groups. The final point worth mentioning is that the Syrian Democratic Forces, the separatist Kurdish groups, they are the ones who have the most to lose as these rebels advance, primarily because they were promised by the Americans, and they've been working very closely with the Americans, that they would be given autonomy in their regions. But it seems that HTS and SNA are targeting those areas where the SDF are as part of their preparations to march on Damascus itself. And I think there have been rumors over the past day or so where there have been some flare-ups in the whole Kurdish-Arab issue that HTS are trying to reconcile by sending Kurds from their own group, you know, Muslim Kurds, to those areas to reassure the local Kurdish populations that, look, this isn't a sectarian thing, it's not an ethnic thing. Jolani's number two came out and gave a khutbah where he said the Armenians and Christians and Kurds and whoever are guaranteed their rights, guaranteed their cause, similar to what we saw when the Palestinians went and marched. So those are the main groups fighting, but everything is still in flux. Russia now is bombing Idlib. There's talk that some militias, pro-Iran militias in Iraq, are trying to cross the border to go in and rescue Bashar al-Assad. It's a bit of a mess, but those are the main groups at this moment in time fighting.
Who runs the Syrian National Army?
The Syrian National Army predominantly is, the consensus is that it is controlled by Turkey. Turkey orders where it goes, where it doesn't go, where it mobilizes, where it doesn't mobilize itself. Without making it sound like it's very pragmatic, Turkey did have a legitimate reason to set it up, which was that at the time before it was set up, HTS, remember, is listed as a terrorist organization. And as a result, whenever Erdogan would go and lobby abroad for support for the Syrians against Assad, he would always be met by the Europeans and the Americans who would tell him, we're not supporting a terrorist group. We're not supporting Jolani. He used to be with Al-Qaeda. Even if he left them, we're not supporting it. So Erdogan's plan was, and this is why it's not as Machiavellian as it sounds, Erdogan's plan was, why don't I create an alternative entity that is not on a terrorist list, that's not composed of people that the Americans don't like, and we can make this the Syrian National Army. Let's remove the legitimacy from Bashar al-Assad, and this way the Syrian opposition will have a leg to stand on internationally because they need international support in order to be able to fight with Bashar al-Assad. Where Turkey had a problem was when they established the Syrian National Army, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham were able to impose themselves in Idlib and in other areas in a way the Syrian National Army could not. And despite certain clashes between the Syrian National Army and Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, Erdogan eventually came to the conclusion that we'll keep the SNA, the Syrian National Army, as a group, but work with HTS, you know, and try to keep the peace between them and try to have this sort of broad coalition between the two itself. SNA is considered Turkey's arm, and this is why, when people are talking about where does Turkey actually stand, was it taken by surprise, did it support the initiative, the deployment of the SNA is what gives you an indication that even if Erdogan may not have wanted this offensive in the beginning, certainly let's see how far it goes and let's support them.
HTS, Al-Qaeda links. Talk to us about that.
So Jolani in about 2016, 2017, the years might be off maybe by one or two. He sets up this hate at Tahrir al-Sham. Bear in mind, the Free Syria Army after 2014, 2015, the people who defected from the Syrian army after the revolution and the Syrians who got together to form behind the Free Syria Army, when they were marching on Damascus, Hezbollah crossed over from Lebanon at the request of the Iranian Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei. They crossed over, they hit the Free Syria Army from the back, and they essentially managed to break the back of the Free Syria Army, which meant that I don't want to use this term, but I'll use it just because it's the way it's used in mainstream. The more moderate forces had their backs broken, which allowed more extreme, I don't like to use this language, but what specifically more extreme forces to emerge. Jolani had a small group, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, and at that time, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, all these other, it was a free-for-all Syria, basically, and everybody announcing their own groups here and there. Hayat Tahrir al-Sham was a small group, so it decided, let's try to form a broad coalition, and amongst those to which it declared allegiance to or coalition with was Al-Qaeda. When it became a bit toxic and they fell out with Al-Qaeda, it was Jolani who led the force against Al-Qaeda to wipe them out from that particular area itself. And he separated from them in 2016, in 2017. But that has stuck with him. That sort of tainted the manner in which people tend to work with him in and of itself. So people are repeating it, certainly again, especially the pro-Assad lot, that this Jolani was also Al-Qaeda and the like. But it is worth noting the reason Al-Qaeda don't operate in Syria anymore in the way that they used to, or even ISIS, or the small groups that call themselves ISIS or the like, is because Jolani is the one who got rid of them. So yeah, they used to have ties to Al-Qaeda, but not anymore. And I think they've rebranded to something much different. And I think when you look at the factions that make up Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, they are much more diverse than they used to be in the past. And I think that shows a reflection upon Jolani. And this is just analysis, not a statement of support for anyone. I think it reflects a reflection upon Jolani that if I'm going to go and march with these forces to take Syria, I need it to look Syrian. I need it to look inclusive and more encompassing. And I think that's what we're seeing today.
Who now runs Al-Qaeda?
Al-Qaeda now is not a particularly a prominent institution. I'm not sure who's running at this moment in time. Their leaders keep getting assassinated one by one. But they're a negligible presence. What I fear is that what we often see is that Al-Qaeda and ISIS card is often thrown at the people whenever they want to topple dictators or regimes. It's used as a card or argument through which to sort of taint the brush of the Syrians who are marching on Aleppo and on Hama itself. I'm not implying that's what the question implied, but it's a very valid question to ask, 100%. But I do think that their role now is negligible, which is why I'm not sure who the leader is, neither are many of the Syrians themselves. But I do think we will hear much more about them as the Syrians advance, because the reality is Assad was able to garner international support to stay in power by arguing that the other side were terrorists and that Al-Qaeda and ISIS were among them. Mm-hmm. And this is what hurt the Syrian revolution a lot. When the Syrian revolution began and it started to be armed, Bandar bin Sultan, who was the head of the Saudi intelligence, had a policy of giving weapons to anybody who would fight Bashar al-Assad. And some of those weapons did find their way into the hands of some terrorist groups. And I think that when people were saying that, look, it doesn't affect the morality of the Syrian revolution, it did make it hard for those who sympathize with the revolution to be very all in with regards to the revolution itself. And you saw it when the Free Syria Army broke apart later on. It was these more extreme groups that sort of emerged into the limelight and emerged to the fore of what happened, etc. I think this time that won't happen. I think this time is different because a lot of these groups have been taken out. What I fear, however, is that as Assad stayed in power by arguing the other side were terrorists, and therefore there will be an increased focus on Al-Qaeda and ISIS, even though their de facto effect is negligible and non-existent, I think they will be inflated in the coming few days to justify Assad bringing in troops from the Iranians. Iran's foreign minister today said that if Assad makes a request for Iranian troops, we will send them immediately. We're seeing, you know, Russia coming in and prepare, you know, doing some military drills off the Mediterranean coast, sort of suggesting that there is this sort of PR narrative being pushed to prepare for a new offensive against these Syrian rebels, against the Syrians. And that's why I fear that folks in Al-Qaeda and ISIS might actually be something that might hurt those who are marching in Aleppo and Hama.
We used to hear Jabhat al-Nusra. That name, what happened to them? Who are they now?
Jabhat al-Nusra rebranded to Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. Jabhat al-Nusra, when Jolani allied with Al-Qaeda, He did so under the brand of Jabhat al-Nusra. And as part of the rebranding, after the cutting ties with Al-Qaeda and the like, they became Hay'at Tahrir al-Sham, which is a much better name when you think of Hay'at, you know, a council for the liberation of Syria. And I think that kind of name allowed other groups to come and join himself. It's not to say his rule has been perfect. There have been quite a few, for those who follow Bilal Abdel Karim, you know, the brother from New York or from America who lives in Syria itself. He's done a lot of documentation about some of the abuses under Jolani's rule in Idlib. But overall, I think Hay'at Tahrir al-Sham and the way that they've managed Idlib itself has been much more inclusive than it has been in the past.
Mossad involvement. Everyone is, a lot of people are talking about this being a Mossad, an Israeli play for an end game that involves dividing up Syria completely into three parts. How can we ever have any certain knowledge on these claims? What do you know about that?
I think that if you look at where Israel stands, Israel does not want a strong Syria. It doesn't want Assad to be entirely in control, but doesn't want the rebels to take over Syria either. So I think that it is legitimate to say that Israel would want to see Assad in trouble. But it is also legitimate to say that that has no bearing on the Syrians' desire for freedom. Because what Israel wants is that there is a stalemate between the rebels and Bashar al-Assad. And given that it was too in favor of Assad, it is true that there may be a case to be made that the Israelis would like to see the rebels push Assad back to a 50-50. So if someone wants to argue that Mossad is watching the rebel advance on Aleppo and on Hama and doesn't mind that advance, there is an argument to be made for that. But I don't think that that affects the Syrian legitimacy in terms of demanding the liberation of Damascus. Because I think that what the UAE are pitching to the Americans and the Israelis is that, yes, Assad is being pushed back, but you don't want Assad to fall. And I think where Israel is concerned is, okay, they're marching, but a bit too rapidly for my liking. They're marching a bit too fast, and Assad is falling a bit too easily for my liking. So right now, I'm happy to watch Assad lose. But if they march on Damascus, I might intervene to rescue Assad. Israel's interest is not in the rebels or in Bashar al-Assad. It's in the stalemate itself. And that's why I think that when people say that Assad was the bastion against the Israelis and Israel wants to see Assad fall, I don't think the Israelis want to see Assad fall at all. They want to see him weak. They don't want to see him fall. I don't think that Saudi Arabia or UAE, Israel's allies in the region, at least UAE, which has normalized ties, and the views expressed on my own don't reflect anybody else. But in any case, the idea that they don't want to see Assad fall as well is because they're aware if Assad falls, it will cause a domino effect that will hurt the regimes and hurt Israel too. And that's why I don't think necessarily Mossad is working with the Syrian rebels. I think more that Israel has an immediate interest in seeing Assad weakened, but no interest in seeing him defeated. And I think that's where people sometimes get confused. They assume that support for the Syrian rebels means you're supporting the Israelis. No, that's not true. Supporting the liberation of Syria is what the Israelis are terrified of. And I do think that when you look at the ceasefire agreement in Lebanon, and again, this is speculation, but I think the timing of the ceasefire and the humiliating terms that Hezbollah accepted, which is the idea of allowing the Israelis to enter Lebanon whenever they wish, terms that they weren't willing to accept beforehand, I think it does have a lot to do with the idea that Hezbollah realized Syria is in trouble and Syria is the greater priority than Gaza. The idea of establishing that Shia crescent that goes from Iran to Lebanon is the greater priority. So make a deal with the Israelis and go and save Syria. And I do think that the Erdogan, he didn't act on Gaza, but he's acting on Syria. I think because from Erdogan's perspective, and indeed Saudi, and indeed many in the region, Iran is currently perceived as the greater threat because of what it did in Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and Yemen. And ignore what that might mean when you put Iran and Israel in the same bracket. The reason people say that is, and this is the point, people often say that Syria is in a mess because Israel and the Americans and the Western powers conspired against Syria. This is a half-truth. It's a half-truth because after the 67 war and 1973, the Americans and the Israelis believed that there needed to be a dismantling of the Iraqi army, the Syria army, and the Egyptian army. Americans began to donate heavily to the Egyptian army and to train them in order to keep them focused more on their people than on outside, and they succeeded in that. Iraqi army, they went in, they brought down Saddam Hussein, and they destroyed the Iraqi army, and now you've seen it's all militias that are roaming around in Iraq itself. And in Syria, indeed, I do think that the Israelis and the Americans want to see the Syrian army destroyed. That's a half-truth. The other side of the truth is that none of the Israeli or US machinations are possible in Syria without the oppression of the Assad family. Ibn Khaldun says, Al-adlu asasul mulk, justice is the foundation of all dominion. Wal-dhulmu mu'dhinun bi-kharab al-umran, oppression is what destroys the civilization. We have famous stories in Islamic history. Umar bin Abdul Aziz radiallahu ta'ala was sent a letter by his governor who said to him, I've got unruly tribes in my area. I need you to send more forces for me to hassinha, to fortify it and keep it under control. Umar Abdul Aziz responded and said, you don't need more forces. Hassinha bil adl. Fortify it with justice. Fortify it by giving people their legitimate desires. And that's why it's a half-truth that Israel and America are conspiring against Syria. It's a half-truth that Israel doesn't like Assad. It's a half-truth that Israel perhaps is happy to see Israel Assad reeling, even if it doesn't want him defeated. But the other side of the truth is that it's the dhulm in Syria itself that allowed the window for these international powers to come out. And I give you an example in not so recent time, in a recent time, 2016, when the army tried a coup on Erdogan. Why were the army unable to do a coup on Erdogan? Because the people took to the streets. They took to the bridges, they took to the streets, and they said, we will not allow you to topple Erdogan because he built the southern cities, he renovated them, he built the roads, he built the hospitals, he built, there was a famous poll after the earthquakes in eastern Turkey, who do you blame for the destruction of the buildings? They said Erdogan. Who do you trust to rebuild it? Erdogan. Erdogan built a record whereby the people genuinely saw him as somebody who builds. Ignore whatever grievances we have over his foreign policy. Assad's dhulm is what led Syria and ripped Syria apart because of dhulm mu'dhum bi kharab al-umran. And that's why when people say we need Assad to stay in power to facilitate Palestinians' liberation, I argue differently. We need justice in Syria to liberate Palestine. Assad has failed in delivering that justice. That oppression needs to go quickly so that we can create an environment of some justice or reconciliation so we can focus on the liberation of Palestine, which is why Salahuddin Ayyubi goes to Syria and Egypt first before he's able to go and liberate Al-Aqsa afterwards.
I mean, we can also ask the question, we just had war in Gaza, and Assad had Syria. Yeah. Where was the help, right? We literally had a live demonstration over almost two years now, and the impact was negligible, right? So that argument is going to be weak, that we need him to help with Israel.
Hey, no, entirely. It's very true. And also, when you look at Assad's position, the reality is that, you know, there are reports coming out suggesting that the deal that the Americans want to offer Assad is abandon the Iranians and we'll come in and rescue your regime as well. Assad is able to be useful to all of the international powers. He's able to shift and align. If it's Iranians are angry with him, he goes to the Russians. Russians are angry with him, he's able to recognize Bin Salman. Bin Salman is angry with him, he's able to talk to the Americans and say, I need you to fight against terrorism. And this is why people who are saying that we need Bashar al-Assad, the reality is they are accepting for themselves what they would not, they're accepting for others what they would not accept for themselves. And here is the tragic irony. And here I talk about those from the Shia who support Bashar al-Assad. The Shia tell the story of Sayyidina al-Hussein, radiallahu ta'ala an, going against Yazid, who they say is a dictator and a tyrant. And they say this story about somebody who valued the freedom and justice of the Muslims so much that he sacrificed himself against the brutal dictator Yazid. How is it that in Syria they flipped it the opposite way, where those who are much more similar to Sayyidina al-Hussein going out and marching for the sake of justice, for freedom, for righteousness, how have they mistook Bashar for al-Hussein and Yazid and made him the rebels, when in reality the story logically should be implemented in the opposite way? Yeah. And that's why I'm not a sectarian in terms of calling, you know, this is against anti-Shia. I'm saying to those who believe in the Shia thought, if you look carefully at your books, if you look carefully at your story, you will find that Ali ibn Abi Talib, radiallahu ta'ala, and al-Hussein and al-Hassan, all of those from Ahl al-Bayt, in my opinion, their stories resemble much more closely the Syrians fighting against Assad than Assad fighting against the Syrians themselves. 100%. And that's why I think even as we talk to, you know, the Shia groups and the like, it's important that we talk about it from the door of da'wah. That guys, you know, Assad is not as good as you think it is. And I think a lot of it, and I finish on this point, I think a lot of the support for Bashar al-Assad that comes from the Shia is out of fear of what Sunnis will do to them afterwards, out of fear of some sort of vengeance. It's almost Zionist in the sense of, we're not going to leave Israel because if these Palestinians come in, they will do this to us, they will do that to us. It's like when you talk to a Jew, I sympathize with the Palestinians, but imagine what they will do to us because of what we did to them. And that's why I think that a lot of the hysteria in Shia support for Bashar al-Assad can be rectified, can be pushed back against with a bit of dawah, using even some of their own books to highlight that what they celebrate is in the Syrian rebels, and what they hate, what they preach, what they hate, is in Bashar al-Assad.
That's a great point. And also, Assad, he's not even managing his own country, let alone helping and facing a huge enemy like Israel. He's a incompetent dictator. Hafez al-Assad was a competent evil dictator. No one messed around in Syria except him. No one oppressed in Syria except him. Today, everyone's meddling in Syria. There are so many hands in Syria, just indicating his pure incompetence as an evil dictator. He's a sloppy, evil dictator that can't even manage his own home and his own country. There's a youth that's in Syria, and he tweets by the name of Tawseef Sharif. And he tweeted recently today saying that the powers that be, I'll let you define who that is, are now trying to carve up Syria into a Sunni portion, a Kurdish portion, and a Shi'i portion. Tell us, number one, I have three questions here. The powers that be, who are they? Who would be the leaders of these three? So when he says Sunni, what does that mean? When he says Shi'i, does that mean Assad? What does that mean exactly? And then number three, your thoughts on the actual truthfulness or accuracy, I should say, of the report.
I think that, first of all, the idea that the Israelis are happy with what's happening, and this links directly to your question. The argument is that as a result of Iran being weakened in Lebanon and Iran being weakened because of its support for Gaza, that means the Israelis are now capitalizing to remove Iranian influence in Syria. And that's, again, a half-truth. The other half-truth is that the reason Syria was unable to act against Gaza or against Israel in favor of Gaza is because Iranian militias are the only forces that are keeping Assad going, and Russian airstrikes are the only forces keeping Assad going. It's not the Syrian army, which is why Assad, in his bid to stay in power, essentially made the state impotent, as you said. Because the state is impotent, there is this suggestion that given that there can be no military victory in Syria because the Russians won't allow the rebels to go to Damascus. This is according to the ones who are doing the plan. The Russians are saying, we don't want the rebels to enter Damascus. We're willing to entertain a deal to split Syria, but we don't want the rebels in Damascus itself. The Iranians are saying, we won't allow the rebels in Damascus itself because we want that bridge that goes from Tehran through Iraq, you know, through Syria all the way to Lebanon, because we believe in this, you know, Shi'i crescent that we're making, which is why Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian general killed by Trump in 2019, you'll see Syrians online on Twitter, they make references to green buses. And those who haven't followed Syria won't know what they're talking about. The green buses were buses that Qasem Soleimani used to load Sunnis on from the southern villages and transport them north and bring Shia from the north and make them live in their homes in the south in order to demographically change those areas. Because he believed that if I brought, and that's why when you go to Damascus, you will see a lot of Farsi on the streets. You'll see Latam now on the streets in the way you did before. Iran really pushed demographic changes. A lot of what Israel did in Palestine, Iranians took a lot from that playbook. The idea of displacing and then bringing, you know, people from India, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Shia, and these places, and putting them in those places itself. Because of these demographic changes, it's been set up whereby there are many Shia now in the south, there are Sunnis now in the northwest, and there are Kurds in the northeast. The American plan initially was, given that the south has now gone to the Iranians, we've been outplayed by the Iranians, there's all these demographic changes, we need the Kurds as a bulwark so we still have a state. The same way the Americans did in Iraq. In Iraq, they went in, they were outplayed by the Iranians who set up all these Shia militias and the like. And Obama, when he wanted to do a nuclear deal because the American people no longer had an appetite for war, Obama said to the Iranians, I'll make you a deal. We'll do a nuclear deal. We'll share power in Iraq. I'll let your militias become part of the Iraqi army. And meanwhile, the Americans in the northern area where the Kurds are, America established a stronghold there that would always antagonize the central government in Baghdad. The Kurds were not allowed to become independent because then they lose leverage in Baghdad. The Americans lose leverage, but they were given almost complete autonomy to do what they wish. So the Americans want to set up, like the same way they did in Iraq, a Kurdistan in the north. They want to set up a Kurdistan in northeastern Syria, which is not independent, but autonomous. So it's independent enough to run itself, but remains autonomous so it can impact Damascus. So, for example, in Iraq, you'll know that the president has to be Kurdish, the vice president has to be Sunni, the head of parliament is Shi'i. They want to do a similar thing whereby in Damascus you have the Kurdish portion, the Shia portion, Sunni portion. In the north, that's so for the south Iran, northeast America, and northwest, the Sunnis reference Turkey. The idea of Erdogan supporting Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, supporting these rebel groups, those who went to Idlib, you'll carve that area out. That might be its own nation or its own autonomous region. The Turks, they will be proxies for Turkey, northeast proxy for the US, and south proxy for the Iranians. Russia is the only one uncomfortable with it, because Russia believes that although it rescued Assad by bombing and the like, the Alawi connection and the Shi'i connection is stronger than the pragmatic connection. And therefore, the Iranians are the ones who will be on the ground and benefiting the most, which is why Russia prefers to keep a stalemate in Syria, where it doesn't split, but it doesn't unite, until it's able to establish its military bases on the Mediterranean and these areas. And the Israelis, I think that they're unsure what scenario they want. Because even if you have a divided Syria, suppose you have a Sunni north and a Shia south that decide to unite, they usurp their masters, usurp and decide to go after the Israelis. It's very difficult. That Sunni-Shia unity might actually come about and the Americans will have to attack them from behind by the Kurds. What happened if there's a dawah to those leftist Marxist Kurds? Because in Turkey, for example, you have half the Kurds religious, half the Kurds leftist. What happens if there's dawah and they suddenly become religious too? They will have a greater affinity for those groups. And then Syria unites on its own after splitting it into three. There are many scenarios at play. But the reference that Tokir was making is this idea that the Turkey does not believe the rebels can go and take Damascus. And therefore their support is limited to perhaps the outskirts of Damascus, and Turkey will agree on a negotiating table, give me this part of Syria, and these are the proxies I'll put there. The Iranians will say, we're tired, we've been smashed in Lebanon by the Israelis, and under sanctions, and Trump might come at us very hard, and we wanna cement our gains in Yemen through the Houthis, cement our gains in Iraq and the like. So we're willing to make a truce, give us the southern portion of Syria, and they put, they've already got a Shi'i demographic now that the Iranians brought in, we'll put our proxy there. And the Americans will say, have it, Turkey's a NATO ally, we can work with the Turks. Iran, we can make a deal with them. And then Trump will say to the Americans, I brought peace to the region. And northeast, we have the Kurds. If any one of the two play up, we will mobilize the Kurds against you and discipline you and keep that separation here and there. And that's why I know it's, I don't want to be the one to put a dampener. As it stands, it may well be that is the more likely scenario. And I think some of the Syrians might say, they could say, that it's better than being under Bashar al-Assad. But we wait to see how fast or how far these rebels can go.
Will Iran use Bashar as their guy in the south?
I think that the Iranians, if Bashar al-Assad is, if it's untenable to use Bashar al-Assad, they can use others as well. Iran always has a roster of leaders it can use. In Iraq, for example, it had Nouri al-Maliki, Haider al-Abadi, Muqtada al-Sadr, Adil Abdel Mahdi. It had all of these various different individuals that it could use. Same trend, same issue, but just different faces. I think in Syria, it's been harder because Bashar al-Assad, the Assad family, has been so entrenched. And also the legitimacy of Iranian presence in Syria was built on the idea that the Syrian president invited us, and as a recognized government, we are the ones legitimate who are here helping him against a rebel group. So it may well be that the Iranians keep Bashar al-Assad, not because they like him, but because technically, internationally, he's still the president of Syria, and Iran can play the idea of international law. And even when you look at the language, we're still talking about the displaced Syrians as rebels and Assad almost as the Syrian state. And I think that language needs to change a bit, which is why, you know, in my opinion, I think that at some point we need to start calling Assad the rebel, because it's Assad who rebelled against the Syrian people. The Syrians had very basic demands. They said, we don't want to live in oppression. For those who've been to Syria, I tell you, interesting, Dr. Shadi, I remember in 2008, we went to play, I went to SOAS University. Actually, you went to SOAS too, yeah.
I did, yep.
So I played for the football team. So in the summer break, we raised money and the university sent us to play against different universities in Turkey, Syria, and Lebanon. I didn't go to Syria and Lebanon at the time. My father was lambasting them on TV and he said, don't put yourself under Assad's risk. But I remember we had to have a briefing before we went where the British embassy would tell us, if you go to Syria, do not talk politics. Don't talk to the Syrians about politics. And remember, the walls have ears. And I remember the students who were with us, you know, my co-students, before they went to Syria, I was like to them, guys, I think you should take that advice seriously. But of course, they were SOAS students. You know them, radical, you know, like occupying their own buildings and stuff. So the story goes, they went to play against Damascus University. So they're having dinner in the canteen, and then they're talking to one Syrian youth, and they managed to get him to speak passionately about the reality of Syria, that this government is a dictatorship, it's corrupt, etc. The next day, they couldn't find him. And to this day, no one knows where he is. He disappeared just for talking to those students. And I think some people tend to underestimate what life in Syria was like. When people say that it was good before, what they're not saying is, it was good when I kept my head down. It was good when I was humiliated. It was good when I had no dignity. It was good when I didn't ask for things, when I just settled for what was given to me. It was good when I lived like cattle, when I lived like sheep. But when I wanted to assert the dignity that Allah gave me, وَلَقَدْ كَرَّمْنَا بَنِي آدَمَ, when I wanted to assert my dignity, ah, look at this mess that I've caused. I think it's very wary when people talk about nostalgia for times that looked stable, but actually were not peaceful. They were stable, but they weren't peaceful, because you talk about something and you get carried away. And that's why I go back to this point. It's like there are some mashaykh in America, prominent ones, we don't need to mention them here, who used to say the Syrians were wrong to rebel. They were wrong to go against Bashar al-Assad. But my problem with that narrative is, you imply that the Syrians had a choice. The Syrians were living in qahr. They were living in dhulm. And I don't think that the one who causes fitna is the one who stands against dhulm. Yeah. I think fitna is the one who causes dhulm.
Exactly. And
the reason why the dictators have held on to power so long is because the quietism that allowed them to get away with literally murder meant that tamado, they went so far that now that they've gone far, only an extreme reaction can push them back. And that's why I think that if you really care about the ummah and you care about stability, you care about peace, then uphold what is right and forbid what is evil the moment that you see it. Don't let it grow the way you're seeing it in a land with, you know, with holy sites. Don't let it grow. Don't be quiet now, because it will get to a stage where you will end up like Syria, where Assad will mobilize the whole state, not because he just because he wants to stay in power, because he's been taught, he's in what's been normalized is, if I use brute force, these people go quiet. If I use brute force, these people don't do nothing. They're just content to live. And that's why I argue that, and I finished on this point, beware of justifying dhulm under the pretext of avoiding fitna. For wallahi, Allah hates dhulm more than al-dhulmu dhulumat yawm al-qiyamah. Dhulm is the thing that Allah hates the most, which is why Ibn Taymiyyah said that Allah will give victory or prosperity, la yansura, Allah will give victory to a just state, even if it doesn't believe, but will destroy an unjust state, even if it believes. For Allah can tolerate justice without Islam, but will not tolerate Islam with injustice. Allah doesn't want his name associated with injustice. Allah hates it more than anything else. And I think as an ummah, and I think this applies in the American context, sometimes in our comfort, we assume we have the world figured out. We haven't been tested with that pressure. And that's why I think we should be wary of lecturing those Syrians who live in circumstances that I don't think any of us would tolerate.
I mean, some messes are actually good, and they're in the process of cleaning up. Anyone who's cleaned anything in their house, you know that the first phase of cleaning, it looks like a disaster, but you're actually cleaning. Even in matters, correcting wrongs in the community, it looks like a fitna. You caused a ruckus and you upset a lot of people, but you actually took out something very bad for the community.
Which you are very good at, by the way, Dr. Shadi.
I'm very good at that. I'm like a specialist. And it's all about, honestly, people, they don't know how to handle pressure. They don't know how to handle the incoming that's going to come. But if you can handle that, you could do a lot in life. And it seems to me a lot of Muslims, especially our ilk, they just don't want to come near any pressure. They don't want to rock any boat. Even if the boat's going off a cliff and is going down, don't rock it. It's like the Titanic is sinking. Don't rock the boat. Well, rocking the boat may save our lives, right? Yeah. So sometimes you need to handle some pressure and you need to handle the reactions of people. And
even on this point, Dr. Shadi, I don't mean to interrupt. Shaykh Bashir Yuthkar, even during the whole campaign, you know, like to, you know, punish genocide and punish Harris, one of the things that I struggled with was I could accept a rational argument for why Democrats might listen to us better. Mm-hmm. What I didn't accept was the argument that AIPAC and these other sides, they're so strong, so we should not rock the boat, we should not shake the status quo because of what they could do to you. Yeah. And my issue with it was, it reminded me of when Quraysh came to Medina in Badr. And what did they say in Medina, some people? They said, "Inna nasa qad jama'u lakum fakhshawhum." They've all gathered against you, they're so powerful, are you stupid? Going out against these people or the like, you know, you're rocking the boat and the like. And they said, it is what it is, hasbunallah wa ni'mal wakeel, and we go out. And even those who, you know, and perhaps in preparation, now we have a Trump administration coming in and they're like, or you have a Trump administration coming in. In any case, with Trump administration, there are some who are saying, Sammy, you know, we punish genocide, but what comes might actually be worse, and it may well be that what comes next might be an Uhud moment. Maybe. I'm just saying, because the Seerah is a guide for life generally. But when the defeat of Uhud came, some in Medina said, if they hadn't gone out and shaken the status quo, if they hadn't gone out and actually defied them and just, you know, kept their heads down and did things in a different way, ma matu aw qutilu, they would not have suffered the fate that they suffered. But what did Allah respond to these people? He said, try and avoid those consequences for yourself. Kun fatru anfusikum al-mawt in kuntum sadiqin.
Yeah, that's true.
He says true. And that's why I always say to amongst my own friends, or they say to me and these others, sometimes we think we say something from iman, but it resembles the hypocrites more than it resembles the Sahaba.
Yeah.
We think, and I know it comes from a good place, but when you read the Quran, you realize, wait, that sounds far more than what the hypocrites of Medina said and what Sahaba said.
100%.
And I think that applies here when we talk about the fitna issue as well.
Those types of people, Yani, you're free to be, I would say, maybe cowardly, but don't lead then. We can't have you people as leaders. Like, we need people who have courage. And it's not for me to tell people to go have uprisings, right? But it's also not for me to say, hey, these Syrian people want liberation of their country. They want to live freely again, and they want to live well. It's not for me to tell them, no, go home and don't cause fitna, right? And so let's go back to this three-part division. So Turkey would manage the Sunni quarter, so-called, right? Who would they put in charge, you think?
The suggestion in the question is that Turkey has the power to put someone in charge. I think Turkey would make an agreement with those who are on the ground and try to influence proceedings on the ground, because I think that it's important we don't take the agency away from the Syrians. I genuinely think that Jolani acted on his own and Turkey is playing catch-up. That they work together, but it's a difficult relationship. It's not a relationship, I order you and you do this. It's more, these are my interests, these are my interests. You need me, but you need me too. How can we work together? Because there's an open enemy there. We won't fight each other openly, but you know, you need to respect me. Mm-hmm. You need to respect me. But on this, so I think that it's not about Turkey putting someone. I think Turkey will do what it's been doing for the past 10 years, making relationships with different groups, trying to organize them into a coalition, respecting the local dynamics, but occasionally saying, this is our preference here, this is our preference there, with a bit of lashing out from the groups here and there, you know, love-hate relationship, things like that. So I think that Turkey, as it stands, Jolani will most likely be in charge of that particular area in and of itself, unless there is some sort of skirmish between them and the Syrian National Army. But I don't see that happening. I don't think Turkey will allow the SNA to clash with Jolani, SNA being the group that the Turks, you know, established the Syrian National Army. I think they will want to keep the peace and keep that there itself. But it's unclear if Erdogan will accept a partition, by the way. I think Erdogan would prefer united Syria, because a partition Syria makes it harder to get the refugees out of Turkey, which is one of the key things that he wants to achieve itself. And also Erdogan, I think, can find room to make agreements with Assad and with the Iranians themselves. I actually think a united Syria is more likely than a divided Syria, because a divided Syria brings its own issues. So, but in to answer your question directly, I think the Turks will keep Jolani there.
Okay, so that means the SNA and the HTS would essentially unify?
Potentially. I mean, sometimes, you know, some of the darker chapters of the liberation movements in our ummah against colonization, they are united against the colonizer and then kill the living daylights out of each other after the colonizer leaves, without any egging on from the colonizers.
Yeah.
Like, and you know, it's the part of the story that I tend to skip over when I talk about the last 100 years. But it may well be that instead of uniting, khalas, they've established a new state. They've, you know, Assad no longer has power there. The Americans have gone off to the northeast of Syria with the Kurds. Iran is staying in the south. There's just Turkey there, which is unable to impose itself. And Turkey will recognize the winner. Yalla, let's fight it out. And, you know, Turkey will recognize the winner itself. You know, I know, it's not that I want to predict bad scenarios, but I do think that it's much harder to unite than it is to fight each other and try to you know, settle the scores and the like itself. So that's why I think the division might lead to more fighting than keeping it unified where you have a common enemy.
The Kurds, are they purely secular Kurds? Because Sunni, Shia, these are religious groups. Kurdish is a nationalist group, but Kurds are Sunnis. So are these, are you talking about secular Kurds?
So the SDF, or Syrian Democratic Forces, they are leftist Marxist Kurds. Erdogan used to dominate in the Kurdish areas in the elections in eastern Turkey because his Islamic rhetoric and Muslim identity meant that most of the Kurds, or a significant chunk of the Kurds who were religious, identified more with Islam than the nationalist identity that the PKK were professing and the like. The relationship actually broke between a lot of the Kurdish groups and Erdogan when Erdogan became more nationalist. They said, we can relate to Islam, we can't relate to Turkish nationalism.
Yeah.
And I think that's where Erdogan had a different relationship with them here. When we mentioned the separatist Kurdish groups, we're talking about the leftists, you know, people who aren't necessarily particularly religious and don't necessarily see a role for Islam there. Which is why in Idlib, amongst the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham and the Syrian National Army, there are a lot of Kurds, a lot of religious Kurds, Kurds who cannot identify with the leftist nationalist identity and still believe in the Ummah. And I think people sometimes neglect in Kurdish history that when the Ottoman Empire fell, the first group to rise to fight Ataturk to re-establish Islam, not a national state, were the Kurds. They fought to re-establish Islam with the help, you know, of some Arabs and these other places as well. So I think that when we talk about the Kurds, we're talking about the separatist minority portion that America has given them disproportionate support, loads of weapons, loads of support, loads of ammunition. This group can't exist without the Americans in the same way that Assad can't exist without the Iranians. That can't be said, though, for the Sunni groups in the Northwest who enjoy relatively, to some extent, popular support, not necessarily because of who they are, but because of their willingness to fight Bashar al-Assad. So the Kurdish groups, I think that, or the separatist Kurdish groups who tend to be Marxist, the irony is that America, which hates communism, is supporting the communists in Syria itself. But I think that it's, if they establish a state, it will be because of the American military base, not because of the power that they have indigenously.
Okay. Everyone's eyes off of Gaza right now. What is happening right now? There probably could be, you know, things happening. Nobody's paying attention. Tell us about that. What is the status going on in Gaza in to the Palestinians right now?
I think Netanyahu is making an attempt now to get settlers into northern Gaza. And I think there are reports that some settlers have made some attempts to establish some homes there, but they've been scuppered by the local resistance in Gaza itself. Israel is still bombing, but I think there is a move or talks to try to achieve some sort of ceasefire. And I think that the reason why I say this is not because of anything the Israelis said. If you saw Trump's tweet, where he said that, you know, if they don't release the hostages by 20th of January, all hell will come upon. I don't think Trump is saying that I will actually bring all hell. I think that Trump maybe has information that Biden is going to negotiate a ceasefire agreement to take credit before he leaves so he doesn't go out as Genocide Joe. And Trump wants to set up a narrative whereby they were so scared of me, they decided to negotiate a ceasefire beforehand. Yeah. I actually think the Israelis are the ones who are in trouble. They haven't been able to annex any land. They haven't made much advancement in Lebanon. Yes, they smashed a lot of Hezbollah leadership, but they're unable to actually take a lot of. Remember, there are a lot of Palestinians in southern Lebanon itself who aren't allowing the Israelis to advance as well, and Lebanese as well, so we don't take credit away from them. On the West Bank, the Israelis are struggling. Biden doesn't want them to take the West Bank because part of Saudi Arabia's conditions for normalization is the recognition of a Palestinian state, however tiny that state might be, and even if it's de facto under Israeli control. I think Gaza is still being bombed. The humanitarian situation is really terrible. And I think that a lot of the reason why it's slipping out the news is not because of Syria. It's because we're still in the process as Muslims of building infrastructure whereby we can actually push narratives and actually keep these narratives in the news itself. Gaza did not become mainstream news because of mainstream media. It became mainstream news because ordinary people were talking about it. And I think it's the duty of podcasts like yours, and I'm not saying you're not doing it, you are doing it, whether it's Thinking Muslim, whether it's Yaqeen, whether it's all these others as well, to continue to make sure that if we talk about Syria in the morning, we're talking about Gaza in the afternoon, and we're talking about Sudan in the evening. We are becoming, you know, the portals through which people are learning about what's happening in the Ummah, not on the basis that we believe the West is going to deliver the solution, but that we have agency to impact decisions that are taking place on the ground itself. And I think that with regards to Gaza, if that public pressure helped to force shifts in global public opinion, and indeed in the decision-making process of many policymakers, it makes sense that we should keep the light on Gaza itself. And if it's any consolation to those who are listening, the liberation of Syria is connected to the liberation of Gaza itself. I think one of the reasons that a lot of the states couldn't go to Gaza's aid, and to be brutally honest about this, is that we still haven't resolved the internal differences. And I don't mean between politics. I mean in the way the region is carved up and the way the region is mobilizing. The reality is Syria is mobilized between, you know, the Iranian militias. Lebanon is immobilized by the Iranian militias. And this isn't sectarian talk. This is the reality of what's taking place. Assad and the Iranians, and I always say this, in Iraq, when the Americans went in, they agreed with the Iranians and the Shia became the heads of government and heads of interior ministry, heads of security. They had a chance to show us what the governance looks like. They had a chance to try to give prosperity, to try to develop and the like. Instead, all we saw was, you know, the banners of Ya Hussein and Ya Fatima and sectarian killings. It's not the Sunni being sectarian. It's the Sunni saying, Ya Ikhwati Shia, please stop with the massacres in Syria. Please stop with the massacres in Yemen. Please stop with the massacres in Lebanon. Please stop coming with the Iranians and slaughtering our population and doing demographic change. We want to focus on Gaza, but you keep hitting us from behind, not the Shia, but the Iranians. You keep hitting us from behind. You keep digging those knives in, and we're bleeding profusely because you claim to be killing us in the name of some 1,400-year-old in Yarmouk in 2014 when Hezbollah surrounded it. When they were bombing the daylights out of Sunnah in Yarmouk, they were saying this is revenge for what Yazid did to Hussein. Yeah, what did I have to do with what Yazid did to Sayyidina Hussein? And that's why I'm saying that beware of being dragged into sectarian talk from the angle of being told to neglect the Syrians for the sake of Gaza. We are one ummah. The liberation of Syria affects the liberation of Gaza. So I would say for those who are worried that Gaza is falling out of the news, I would say focus on Syria, focus on Gaza, and don't feel too bad about it, because Syria may lead to the liberation of Gaza itself. And those who are following Gaza, the Gazans are talking as well. And inshallah, we'll see you hear good news from both fronts soon, inshallah.
We kept you for an hour, but I have a couple final questions, two final questions. News sources. So much of what we're getting is hearsay, or maybe you trust it, but do you have no sources? I know journalists like to keep their sources close to their chest, but who do you recommend the common everyday Muslim wants to keep up with the news, but also wants facts, wants to know something certain? Which journalists, which sources, Twitter accounts, websites, what have you?
I think that, look, Twitter is wonderful in terms of ascertaining the trends from the different sides. Mm-hmm. And the commonalities will tell you what facts are taking place on the ground. For example, if a pro-Iranian tells you that forces are marching out of Damascus and heading towards, you know, Aleppo, it means there's a crisis in Aleppo. Mm. Even if you're reading on the other side that we've liberated Aleppo, it shows you that something is happening there in Aleppo itself. I think that politics can often be understood by trends. What does Turkey want? That doesn't change overnight. That's a consistent trend over the past 10 years. Read what Turks are saying. Read what Syrians are saying. Read what Assadists are saying. Read what the Iranians are saying. Read what UAE are saying. Read what Bin Salman is saying. Read what the Saudis are saying. You will find the commonalities and the thread, and you can put it on a whiteboard and you'll be able to see what's happening in terms of where the interests lie and where things are going itself. If you want briefs or general just overviews, you don't have the time. The reality is that you've got things like, you know, the other journalists, like, you know, or outlets, whether it's the New Arab, whether it's, you know, even reading things like the New York Times. I know that there's a lot of misinformation there, but it tells you how the Americans are viewing what's happening too. I often think the issue is not sources. The issue is the lens through which you interpret the information that you're getting. And I think a lot of that has to do with memories of the Ummah. And the reason why I say this is that if you sit with Syrians and hear their stories about, you mentioned Hafez al-Assad. Chances are you got those stories from Syrians and sitting with them, and they poured their memories into your head and they gave you a glimpse of what the world looks like through their eyes. The more you inherit those lenses, the more you're able to interpret the information that comes out. 10 different people can put out the same information. 10 will interpret it differently based on the lens that they have. Learn the history of Syria and the memories of Syria. You'll interpret Syrian news easily. If you don't have those memories, you'll apply a memory that's unique to a different country, to a country where it has no relevance. Like the people who say that in Bangladesh, we're worried what happened in Egypt will happen in Bangladesh. They're two different memories. Yeah. You say that because you don't know the Bangladeshi memory. Inherit those memories and you'll find the moving pieces might not be the same moving pieces in Egypt. I know that sounds vague. It's much easier when you have like a clear case example. But with regards to Syria, follow those who are supporting this push towards Aleppo. Follow the Assadists, see what they're saying. The more they panic, the more they're actually in trouble. Follow what the Iranians are saying when they say that if Syria asks us for troops, we will send troops. That means that they're preparing for something. Follow what the Russians are saying. For example, one of the spokesmen said that it's Assad's fault because he refused to agree with the negotiations, which tells you the Russians are frustrated, which means they might allow the rebels to get to the outskirts of Damascus, but not into Damascus itself. All of these give various hints here and there. And don't forget, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala created an ummah, not an individual. We have to keep talking to each other, bouncing the ideas off each other, because often you find you have half the information and Sheikh Shadi has the other half of the information. Bring them together, it becomes whole. Talk to each other, because politics ultimately is the science of human relations. It's a human science, so it's humans who should be the sources. And just go out and see, and I think that's the best way to do it.
Wonderful answer. Last question. Let's come back to the United States for a second. Going forward, there was a lot of momentum, but now that the election's over, that momentum's got to stay. I had an idea that in terms of American elections, one of the quickest ways to figure out which one should be voted out is just look at the AIPAC numbers for each candidate, right? Any race that's going on, whoever has more AIPAC money, vote for the other guy.
Go the other way.
What do you think of that strategy?
That's a sound tactic, and I think it's something people should plan for the next 2 years. I actually think, and I just throw this idea out there, in January and February, there are delegate elections for the Democrat Party. Mm-hmm. And I think that Democrats in this period of reflection, it's worth sending people to engage in that debate. People that you can trust in the community. The delegate is the one who goes to the party. They talk about policy and the like. They may have no influence on the eventual policy, but they can ensure that the debate continues, because if they're pushed to do something that is against their values, they can just resign. Mm-hmm. But it's worth being in that space, not to support them, but to ensure that, because I saw today that one of Harris's campaign managers is trying to downplay the role of Gaza. Hmm. Bernie Sanders didn't. Neither did Rouhana. Neither did The Hill. Neither did AOC. They're all saying that Gaza played a major role. Why not get a few delegates to go into that Democrat Party when they have their period of reflection and say, guys, if you ever want to win an election again, you can't. And bear in mind, Michael Moore, who was telling Muslims that don't punish Harris because of Gaza, because Trump will be worse. Michael Moore has an article from 2 days ago. He says, I am telling the Democrats today that maybe we should no longer be seen to be too close to the Zionists. I don't know if you've seen it, you should search it. He said, I'm telling the Democrats that it might be a liability to be seen to be too close to the Zionists. This is happening in a period of reflection. Why don't you send in a few delegates to tell them Michael Moore's right? Michael Moore says that. And that's why I think that that could be the next year. And then the midterm elections, when they come, we do the Shadi strategy. We that's say it. To them, guys, where AIPAC is, go the opposite way. Just put that power in. By the time the third year comes and elections are around the corner, presidential elections, I think the parties will treat you very differently. Yeah. And I argue, even with those who endorse Trump, it is worth going to Trump and telling him, Trump, you said it yourself. You won this election because of the way we swung some of those swing states for you. Mm-hmm. Now, you have a chance to keep it. The Republican Party has a chance to keep some of those votes. But there's going to need to be some sort of concessions here and there. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with da'wah. I'm not talking about concessions to values that we don't like. Here, I'm just talking about da'wah. That we supported you here. We want this. There's nothing wrong with doing it. Even if it doesn't succeed, that doesn't defeat the purpose of da'wah in its essence, in terms of being participants in that debate. Because if we could convince 10 million Americans, Sheikh Shadi, to sit out the election. Remember, Trump didn't increase his vote. Trump got 74 million in 2020, 75 million in 2024. In 2020, Biden got 81 million. Harris got 71 million in 2024, which means Trump didn't win. Democrats lost. What made those 10 million stay at home? Don Lemon and other journalists went and asked them. They said, I didn't want to vote for a fascist or a genocider. Where did they get genocider from? Amazing. Who told them they were genociders? Who showed? It was da'wah. It was literally da'wah in the full meaning of the word. I don't call it political da'wah. I don't call it spiritual da'wah. It was da'wah in its full meaning of the word. Why not push that da'wah further forward? And I agree with, I think that's a very good strategy. And I think there are a few people, you know, moving around on the ground, you know, trying to organize stuff here and there. Yep. I'm just a guest, you know, a foreigner who's just providing analysis here and there. And I have no involvement. You asked the question, I just answered. Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen.
This strategy's got to be simple, right? Yeah. And someone's got to be punished. We're not going to have anyone doing bidding for us, but we can knock people out. If we're swing boats in different states. You're in Dallas right now. Does that mean you're doing a U.S. tour, or are you going to come to Jersey?
I'm going to Michigan, and then I have a final, and then I'm supposed to go Atlanta, Houston, and then head off back to London.
Oh, okay. How did we miss out on this tour that we didn't have you swing by?
I'm waiting for you to come to London. You need to come to London.
I'll come to London.
That's about the U.S. experience, and I'm waiting for you in London.
I will come to London then. I will come, and we'll get an auditorium, and we'll have two chairs, and we'll talk.
Inshallah. inshallah.
Thank you so much for everything. Jazakallah khairan. Thanks for coming on. Barakallahu feek as usual. And may Allah give you success in your tour.
Shukran.
Wa alaikum salam. All right, there you have it. That was a really good analysis, and we're going to keep our eyes on whether Syria will be divvied up into these three groups as Tawqir Sharif, who is a British, I don't know if he doesn't live in England anymore, but he lives in Syria. And I just discovered his people sending me his Twitter account, and because he's in Syria, that tends to lend some legitimacy to what he's saying. Sunnis in the north, northwest, Kurds in the northeast, I think, if I got that right, and Shia in the south, which is more like Iran, America, Turkey. Those are going to be the ones, the proxy. And you want to see when someone's weak, see how many people are pulling strings. You know, like in a household, if you got the mother-in-law pulling strings, and then you got the friend pulling strings, and then the dad pulling strings, and meanwhile, the husband is there. It's got chaos in his house. He's a weak man. Same thing is happening in Syria. Everyone's got a hand. Okay, so there is a dictator, and then there's the incompetent, pitiful, pathetic dictator, which is why the guy was an optometrist. You know, I think he went to SOAS too. Bashar al-Assad, I think he went to like University of London. Look at his back. The guy's an optometrist. The guy's an eye doctor. You look at his face, he looks like he should be an accountant, an insurance adjuster, a dentist. This is not a dictator. No, this is not a strong man. And clearly, you see his country now, everyone's got a hand in it. And they're going to divvy up his country under his own watch. Bilal Abdelkarim. I saw that. And yes, maybe I will have him on and have his opinion and have his... Because it's all pieces of information. He's very dead against Al-Jawlani, according to his visit on Mad Mamluks. He says Al-Jawlani is not an Islamic approach. That's a judgment based on what he's seen, Bilal Abdelkarim, and I'll follow some more of his interviews out there. Yeah, it's one of the biggest streams we've ever had, and have we done something? We have an opportunity to do something physical. Yes, we can't go in and fight. I would love to go in and fight. I'm telling you that you have to have influence. You have to have impact. I don't like to just be a citizen here having, did not the Prophet say, change it with your hand. When you see a munkar, change it with your hand. I just read this hadith and the Sharh of Nawawi on it. You see a munkar, change it with your hand. That's, of course, if you have legal authority to do so. Okay? I'm going to stick the GRT thingy on so we can see how we're doing there. If you can't change it with your hand, because you have no legal authority, as we do. We don't. You go in, they're going to say you join a terrorist group, unless you actively give up your citizenship. That's an option. Become stateless. Tell the U.S., hey, U.S., could you cancel my subscription to U.S. citizenship? Right? And be stateless like some of these British guys are. And go fight. Right? If you're going to do that. But we can't advocate doing something illegal, which is being a citizen and then being part of these other groups. Okay. So, but if you can't do that, change it with your tongue. If you can't do that, change it with your heart. Imam An-Nawawi says, when the Prophet says that is the weakest of faith, it doesn't necessarily mean that that person's faith is weak. What he means is that that's the weakest expression of faith, the weakest impact of the mu'min. And that's really where we are. Where our impact is, who wants to have a weak impact? And I've said it earlier in the stream, and I talked to my sheikh about it today in fiqh, and we were talking and saying, why is it that our group doesn't have any presence in this? Our aqidah, our menhaj in the four madhabs amongst the Asha'ira and amongst the people of Al-Ghazali and Tasawwuf who love these things. I don't see a Ash'ari brigade out there, right? I wish I did, I have to tell you. I mean, I don't want them to be terrorists or doing anything illegal. But I mean, I don't like to be impotent either, right? I mean, why are we? But by the way, he did say, you know what? There are, you just don't know about them. He told them about the Naqshbandis of Iraq. They're the ones who did Fallujah. Now, we're not supposed to celebrate that because they did it against the Americans. But you know, King George did far less And then George Washington, TJ, and all these other guys, they went out there and did the American Revolution for far less. We're a culture of revolutions. And we know in a Sharia, we know we have rules on revolution. We know that. Rebellion, there are limits. Yeah, but the American spirit, alleged, supposedly, you know, it's changed now. The American spirit was, don't come near my rights. Don't come near my freedoms. That was the American spirit. Now I think the American spirit is, don't come near my Wi-Fi. Don't come near my porn. Don't come near my drugs. Don't come near my abortion. That's what the American spirit is now, right? But the don't you want agency? Why do we sometimes treat Israel as if it's an omnipotent force in the world? You can't do anything. The Zionists will shut you down. Even when he said Michael Moore said, you know, maybe the Democrats shouldn't be so close with the Zionists. I thought the first reaction was like, all right, that means Michael Moore is going to have a scandal in 2 weeks. Some video is going to pop out of Michael Moore doing something wrong, right? That's the immediate knee-jerk reaction you get because of this belief that these guys have so much power and they're such an evil empire and a dark force. You can't even say anything. You can't treat people like they're omnipotent. And you'd rather go down putting up a fight. But I'm telling you, if it was somewhere legal, somewhere lawful, somewhere, and then lawful in whose world? In Syria, is there a law that's legitimate to be respected? In Syria? In Iraq, what's going on? In Libya, what's going on? I'm telling you, we need the Ash'ari Brigade. ASJ, Ahl Sunnah. And you know what the J stands for. Ash'ari Sufi Brigade. Anyway, I mean, we're all... And let me tell you something else too, something that I tweeted out as a policy. In these matters, the identity is Muslim. That's the number one identity that matters. And when I mean Muslim, not as an identity, I shouldn't say... Let me rephrase that. The agenda. Islam. In the broadest sphere. If someone is directionally honoring Allah and His Messenger and the Prophet and the Quran and Islam, he may be of a whole nother manhaj. I don't care. But if he's generally there and he's opposed with atheists, Marxists, Zionists, Israel, US, Russia, whatever it is, I mean, I can't say US. Just delete. Highlight, delete that. I got to keep my citizenship for now. But yeah, we got a stream. I'm also selling a house. But that's who I'm siding with. I don't care if, like, locally in our ummah, I don't talk to him. You got to have a brain. You can't fight two wars at the same time. I can't go having an internal dispute that I have with someone on aqidah, on different manhaj things, and take that to the state, to the arena of international politics. It makes no sense. Tell me I'm wrong on this subject. So in Egypt, I know they go crazy when I say this, but I don't care. In Egypt, I don't know the people down there. I don't have any beef with anybody in Egypt. I don't even know the people. But the secularists and the Ikhwan. Afghanistan. The Taliban and the Americans. Israel. Gaza. Hamas versus Israel. I'm not part of any of these groups. I probably may not even agree with any of these groups on major things. But at that moment, at this arena, that's who I'm supporting that cause. That generally, people who respect God and His Prophet and honor Allah and His Messenger, we can't just dismiss that. Yassin, why are you looking so hip today? What's going on with you? Who dressed you up today? We got two Moroccan Yassins here. Yeah. We got two Moroccan Yassins here. MashaAllah. You came back from California and he's looking like a hipster completely. But you see, that's sort of my leaning. And I don't say I affiliate myself with any group. I don't believe in that, right? But that's the approach that I'm trying to say. In Turkey, Erdogan versus the secularists. So my heart is going to lean towards that group. I'm going to want them to see. Even if I say they're terrible, right? But are they as bad as kuffar? Are they as bad as atheists and Marxists and secularists and Ba'athists and all these things? Now, if they're... It's a principled approach. So, yes, they may be pious Muslims, but now they're acting impiously. As Bilal Abdelkarim, I think you just said his name was, I saw his clip, says that, yeah, the HTS came with an Islamic spirit, but they oppressed a lot of people in the jails. Their prisoners are tortured. And that's really the judgment. Not the judgment isn't they treated an irrelevant minority group well, or that they treated the kids well and the streets. Yeah, that the kids don't harm you. Your weakest link are the prisoners. And Bilal Abdelkarim, he said that they treat them terribly. So the point being, it's principled. If you're directionally in that position where you're honoring God and his prophet, that's the group. But if you start misbehaving, then I can't support you. Because he said earlier, and that's the position we believe in, if you're a believing people, but you're unjust. And that you're harm, and the unjust cannot be a soldier did this. No, the injustice has to be that which is ordered from the top. Organized injustices. Right? Or they're letting them go. They're letting them do these things. Then at that point, we retract our support. It's simple as that. You retract it. It's simply a matter of principles. You abide by these principles. But at the arena, in the world arena, it's like it's you're just going to go with that which is closer to you. Even if within our ummah, we have nothing to do with each other. Swallow your pride. Be pragmatic. Follow priorities. And also blame yourself. Why don't you have any players, right? Why don't you have any people who are, you know, with the aqidah that you... That's tough luck for you that you're doing. Just blame yourself. Instead of sitting out and saying, oh, he's not from my hizb, he's not from my menhaj, so I'm just not going to support him at all. Okay, so you're going to support the Ba'athists, the Marxists, the secularists, the atheists, what have you? And that and none of that means that you support everything that that group does. None of it means that. It just means in their battle between the kufr or the evil, that you're going to support one over the other. And the qiyas on that is the companions themselves, who supported a Christian nation, which were the Byzantines, over a pagan nation. That doesn't, obviously they don't actually support 100% the, no, in this battle they support, in this face-off, that's who they supported. So I take the same qiyas. If right now there is a war between Israel and Iran, I'm going to be with Iran. Or no, you could say nobody, you could say stay out of everything. That's an option too. But no, I would go with Iran, right? Then that's with so much difference between, but this is situational. I'm not supporting them mutlaqan. I'm not supporting them absolutely. I'm not like with them. But in this situation, just as the Prophet ﷺ supported, and the Sahaba, I don't know if the Prophet spoke on this, but we know that the Sahaba were pulling for the Byzantines over the Persians. Christians, at least they're within the realm of prophets, God, angels, heaven, hell, versus the pagans who are in a whole nother world. So that's the idea that you're going to go with. Americans, communists, I will go with the Americans. Communists are complete Marxist atheists, and the way they treated Muslims was far worse. I mean, they just had no problem wiping everyone out. And then belief in God, setting up any churches, anything was completely out of the question for them. It was something they fought openly. Whereas the Western civilization, yeah, they got obviously were not supported. They got their issues, complete secularists too, but at least their approach towards these things was not as aggressive. They weren't officially atheist, and that's the difference. So if someone wants to refute that, if you want to refute that, it's a matter of opinion, and I've shared this opinion with many scholars, and they said, yeah, it's called the fiqh of priorities, and it doesn't mean, you know, retweet doesn't equal endorsement. On this moment, at this moment in time, this is who I'm going with, right? At this moment in time. And you can stay silent too. Ladies and gentlemen, we got to stop. unfortunately, we have to go. We got class. If you want to take classes with me and with other scholars, well, I'm not even a scholar. But I can say I'm a teacher, and I'm teaching some fundamentals here of aqidah, fundamentals of fiqh, fundamentals of tasawwuf, fundamentals of ulum al-hadith and ulum al-Quran. That's what I teach. Been doing that for many, many years, and I am a student of knowledge. I'm a student of three different shiyukh at this moment of time, and I encourage everyone to live and die as a teacher and a student. As soon as you learn something, teach it, and never stop studying. But you can go to arcview.org. arcview.org and sign up. And alhamdulillah, we did reach our goal, and we passed the 6,500 pounds that we wanted to reach. We got it to 6,700 pounds. 6,700 pounds is going to the winter drive in Syria. Brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, jazakum Allah khairan. Subhanak Allahumma wa bihamdik. Nashhadu an la ilaha illa anta. Nastaghfiruka wa natubu ilayk. Wal asr. Inna al-insana lafi khusr. إلا الذين آمنوا وعملوا الصالحات وتواصوا بالحق وتواصوا بالصبر والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله.